Groups Summer School at the Cenacle, Grayshot. Monday morning, 13th April, 1981. Last Saturday, day before yesterday, we tried to consider some very deep matters indeed. The origin of all things in terms of a primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy and of pure or absolute consciousness. And we tried to see very briefly and on the surface actually the different grades of being that come into existence when that origin wakes up, shall I say, out of its state of vibrant quiescence and releases the entire cosmos. And we saw, or rather tried to see, how this process results ultimately in grosser and grosser forms of structure, ultimately ending in what we call matter. And associated with all these grosser structures is also consciousness, the pure consciousness, which becomes locked up in these forms. It loses some of its dimensions, which are altogether transcendent to us, and finally ends up in the animal kingdom, in ordinary simple consciousness. In man, that consciousness has begun to emerge on the, what we may call, the upward path. The return to the realization of transcendence itself from whence it came. Now, consciousness in the supreme sense is something which is utterly different from what we call consciousness. Ours is a discriminative consciousness. It is associated with our tendency and the actual way we function to analyze, to split up things, and thereby the fundamental unity, the unitary wholeness, or holiness if you like, of the origin is split up. And this is the state of sin, meaning the state in which, because consciousness splits, discriminative consciousness splits things up, the unity, the original unity of the universe is hindered, at least, if not broken up. Now, if and when we can grow out of the limitations imposed upon us by our discriminative consciousness through the complete purification of the psyche, if and when we can do that, we become increasingly conscious in the transcendent sense. Now, that does not mean that we become conscious of the totality of the cosmos as so many things, integrated, even if integrated as a complete whole. It means that consciousness in itself is so complete, so perfect, so utterly at one with the activity of the creative process that it the creative process goes on unknowingly. That means, to use a simple phrase, the divine activity of the origin takes place naturally, spontaneously. It doesn't know it. One of the purposes, if you like to so consider it, of this process of differentiation and the imprisonment of consciousness, one of the purposes is that that transcendent source, that transcendent origin, may come to know itself. This is put in various ways in the different scriptures of the world, particularly in Hinduism. Brahman or Atma desired a second because it was alone. It felt a loneliness, desired to know a second, and therefore caused itself, which was the positive-negative, male-female, conjoined as one whole. It caused itself to fall apart into two parts. And one part was the negative, the female, the other part was the masculine, the male. It is the female which is the which does all the doings, so to say, as far as the evolutionary process is concerned. When we become truly conscious of something, we don't know it with the brain. We are that thing, completely that thing in mind and consciousness. And therefore, as a result of that, because consciousness in itself, something which we don't know, has this creative power, it expresses itself through all our thought and feeling, our words and our actions, according to the intensity with which our consciousness is one with the truth, the ultimate truth. It is the creative source. Our states of mind or feeling must not be mixed up with consciousness. Consciousness as such, as it functions in us as we are, is discriminative. It is the analyzer, it is the mechanical synthesizer. But consciousness, when liberated from its limitations here and now, is the creative agent. It is the living integrator. That means that it functions in terms of continuous growth. All growth is an integrating process. From one state of integration, live integration, it releases itself into the next state of live integration. Such is consciousness in itself. If, for instance, we are truly conscious of wisdom or of love, then our whole life, our whole psychophysical life, in terms of our thought and feeling, our words and our actions, will naturally and spontaneously fully express that wisdom or love. But the brain won't know it, because it happens naturally and spontaneously, and there is no need for the brain to act the part of the external or internal observer of something which is happening externally. The love and wisdom is no longer external, something to be attained or achieved or which needs to be developed and so forth. It just happens naturally and perfectly. That is why the perfected holy ones were called the sinless ones. They who had completely passed beyond all sin, all evil doing. Look at the definition of the word Purusha in the Upanishads. And Purusha means the person. You'll find it in the first chapter of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. It shows clearly that the word Purusha means he in whom all evil-mindedness has been burnt out. All evil-mindedness has been burnt out. And evil is associated with the process of differentiation and separation. Now, it is very important for us to understand this, because willy-nilly, our natural selflessness drives us to attain or to achieve the deep states of consciousness and so forth. And we express it in various ways. We think thereby that we are moving heavenward or towards perfection or something. Nothing of the sort. We only move heavenward in our imagination and end up with a bump on the earth again. Sometimes it is an unpleasant bump. When we discover how excuse me how conceited we are, and how greedy we are to grasp at the heavenly. We give up the earthly as an exchange for the heavenly. Shopkeepers all along the line. Money changers in the temple of the Lord. So that we must clearly understand, that this consciousness which emerges as the discriminative consciousness becomes purified is an unknowing consciousness. It functions all the time in terms of action. Because of that consciousness, all action is holy. You see, so that's how it happens. And then there is no conflict of humility on the one hand and conceit on the other hand. We are naturally humble, we have natural humility and openness, a complete state of openness, because of which we are constantly learning and we don't fail to learn. And by that sort of learning, we confer teacherhood upon everyone around us, upon everything around us, in fact upon the whole universe. And we learn also from our own existence, our own psychophysical organism. The body itself is one of our greatest teachers, if only we knew how to learn from it. Now, on Saturday we also saw that what we call the psyche is something which is specific to us. It is the result of this characterless universal energy, this archetypal form, this particular archetypal form of the primordial creative energy, which, coming in contact with matter, the body and body, gives the rise to psyche. And the psyche in every single body is different from everybody else's, for the very simple reason that our structure, our physical structure, the brain and nervous system, the activity of the ductless glands and so on, are all different in different people. Every single one has a different structure and a different bodily functioning. And because of this, this characterless energy called mind takes the specific form of your own psyche, and therefore your own processes of thought and feeling and action and so forth. Now, we also saw that at least we didn't see very deeply, but we just touched upon the main point, that our difficulty where the psyche is concerned arises out of, it has its roots in the pleasure-pain mechanism of the body. The body has, by nature, a pleasure-pain mechanism which safeguards its existence. If the body approaches a fire, a raging fire, it shrinks back quite soon, and so on. You see, if it is going through a pleasurable experience, it accepts it as part of its life process, and therefore it doesn't go away from it. Now, this pleasure-pain mechanism of the body has its psychical counterpart. The psyche says, I like this, I want more of it. And it never knows where to draw the line. So we see greed developing on the one hand. Greed and the passion to grasp at everything for self, to possess for self. On the other hand, when we have some unpleasant experience or painful experience, the psyche says, I don't like this, I must get rid of it, or I must destroy it. And thus arises aversion, hate. You get attachment on the one hand, aversion on the other hand. Greed and hate are associated with both. So you get this constant conflict born of the sickness of the psyche. The psyche gets clogged up. with these reactions, and also it gets clogged up with all the imposed ideas and thoughts which are given unto us by our own society, by all around us. First and foremost, by our parents. Parents have little conception of what they are responsible for. If only parents had real understanding and some real inward poise and purity, then the children of the world would be very, very different, and the whole world would be a very different place. It starts there. Upbringing is the starting point. And then then there is introduced the idea of oneself as a separate person, named I with self-reference and named you with reference to all other people. This I am I am John, or I am Mary, or whatever it is. But that person is something else, and the name is also something else. Also, the growth of speech and the use of language introduces ideas which get locked up in the brain in various ways. Many of them are, of course, essential, indispensable for physical existence. That, of course, we must acknowledge as a fact. The know-how of physical living depends upon accurate, correct ideas which are in the brain. If in England you drive on the right-hand side of the road instead of the left-hand side, there will soon be some awful trouble. So if the brain knows that you must drive on the left-hand side, and it knows exactly what that implies and so forth, well, then you don't get that trouble. So this conditioning of the brain goes on all along the line through all our experience. Practically all of which in childhood comes through the avenues of our senses. And because these impositions, these conditioning factors play their part upon the brain from infancy onwards, it is very difficult for the person who is growing up to have what we may rightly call an open mind, ready to learn directly from all experience. We are taught. That means we are conditioned all along the line. And as I said a few moments ago, part of that condition is inevitable and necessary. Otherwise, there is trouble. But a great deal of that conditioning hinders our true growth and living in such a manner that we do fulfill the purpose of our existence. This has to be borne in mind. Now, since the pleasure-pain mechanism is the root source of all our psychical state, the ill state of our psyche, as well as that aspect of our psyche which is not ill. We live in a dualistic condition. We are constantly ambivalent. And so all our values are bedeviled by this ambivalence of the psyche. The question arises, how shall we deal with this ambivalence of the psyche? Provided, of course, we have even some sort of opportunity to have some sort of vision, however dim, of the purpose of our existence, which means also some sort of sensitivity, not just fixed brain knowledge in terms of a definite set philosophy, but some sort of sensitivity as to the nature of our origin, the way we are moving through life, and our development, and the sort of the nature of the fruition and fulfillment which awaits the which is the end point, so to say, of our psychophysical development as such. One of the most important factors here, of course, is the factor of speech. We learn everything through the spoken word when we are very young and through the written word as we grow older. We read. Speech is of the utmost importance because in terms of language, in terms of speech, all our sense experience, all that comes to us from outside is synthesized. It is, our brains are a tremendous card index, so to say, of mental constructs. Now these constructs, mostly, the bulk of them, are obstructions to our real opening out in the deep sense of pure consciousness and of the vision of reality and truth, the understanding of and the understanding of truth. But see how everything that we do, everything that we think, is expressed in terms of speech. What did the Buddha teach in connection with speech in his fourth precept of the comprises the moralities? He says, and this is just an abbreviated abstract from the original text, abstain from all speech that is lying, slanderous, harsh, or rude, from all frivolous talk and vain or low conversation, from all wrangling disputation, from all speech that is tricky, deceptive patter, and refrain from droning out holy words for pay. Any priests here? All speech must be truthful, blameless, note carefully, pleasant to the ear, lovely, reaching to the heart, refined or polished, dealing essentially with living religiously, deep, in season, at the right time, the right place, and meaningful. The speaker must be faithful, trustworthy, a man of his word, a reconciler of those who are divided, an encourager of friendship, a peacemaker, an ardent lover of peace whose words make for peace. What a wonderful, what a wonderful teaching, and so fully expressed, so succinctly. We do not appreciate that by far the greater part of our life is in speech forms. Everything needs the medium of words, of language, in order to be carried out. Here is a quotation from a hymn in the Rig Veda. It's in the 10th book, hymn 125. Now this presents that aspect of speech which helps us to obtain some sort of vision of reality and of the extraordinary overriding influence of speech in our whole life, not only psychophysically and outwardly in the world, but also as far as the inner world is concerned. It is a hymn which is addressed to speech personified as a goddess. And it presents the height and depth of speech. I have only made a few extracts from the whole hymn. Through me alone, all eat the food that feeds them. This is not the literal food that we eat with our mouths, but the food, anna, it means sustenance. Whatsoever sustains the psychophysical life is termed food, anna, in in Sanskrit. I make the man I love exceeding mighty, make him a sage, a rishi, and a Brahman. Who is a rishi? The literal meaning is a singer. But in the religious context, the rishis and the maharishis were the singers of the songs of eternal life. Those were the rishis. And one can see that whoever presumes to self-style himself as a rishi and worse still as a maharishi is something of a rogue. And the word Brahman, as very clearly pointed out in the Vajrasuchi of Upanishad, is a man of any caste or any social group whatsoever who has realized Brahman, realized transcendence. That is the true meaning of the word Brahman. And that is the sort of person who is really fit to be a teacher, a spiritual teacher. The Buddha himself, if you study the Mahavagga, the first few pages of the Mahavagga, it is given there, the Buddha says that he who has become utterly purified of all evil, and he who has reached the end of the Veda, meaning the peak point of all true knowledge, well, he is the person who, if he is not self-obtrusive, he is fit to speak the holy word, the Brahma word. Now note that very carefully, because so many people, and especially when we are young, we get the passion to help others, to save the world and all the rest of it. We have our own philosophies spun out, and we try to impose them upon others, not knowing that we are just imposing. This is an expression of power lust in oneself. The limited self asserting itself in any and every situation. Mind you, they may be speaking things which are accurate, which are factually so, but it is the manner and the way in which it is done and the circumstance in which it is done which shows whether it should be done thus or not thus. This is very important. Then the hymn goes on. I have that is speech, the goddess speech says, I have penetrated earth and heaven. Earth in the scriptures, certainly the Indian scriptures, refers first and foremost to your own psychophysical organism. This is the world. And this also is the Garden of Eden, the psychophysical organism, actually. That is earth. And heaven, of course, refers to those states of consciousness in which, even in our psychophysical condition, we are free of binding limitations. That we have understanding, we have vision, we have love, we have wisdom, goodness, truth, purity, beauty. We have all those. That is heaven. On the world's summit, I bring forth the Father. Remember that these people were masters of yoga. The world's summit is the Sahasrara Chakra. Refers to the Sahasrara Chakra, which is associated, of course, with the brain, this thousand-petaled lotus, as it is called. On the world's summit, I bring forth the Father. It is stated in the Rig Veda that the world consists of two halves joined together like two ladles and their stem joined together. That is the world. Now, of course, the two ladles joined together, you know the suture here, and it is the two halves of the brain, the left side, the right side. The right side of the brain is what is referred to as the spiritual heart in man, something which is not known. People wonder whether there is a wonderful, mysterious spiritual heart situated somewhere in the enclosed by the right rib cage. It isn't. This is the spiritual heart as such, because when that is activated, and it gets activated through our own complete purification, then our whole spiritual, psychophysical, organic being is functioning fully and perfectly. My home is in the waters, in the ocean. Thence I extend over all existing creatures and touch even yonder heaven with my forehead. Speech does that, because after all, the supreme things here in our physical existence are expressed in speech. How else are they expressed? You can, of course, draw pictures which are which have a remarkable power of inspiring the onlooker and awakening his dormant sensitivities to reach out towards the transcendent. We also have wonderful music which does that. We also have wonderful poetry. The great arts are really next to the purely religious aspect of our existence and life. It goes on, I breathe a strong breath like the wind and tempest, the while I hold together all existence. Wind and tempest generally tends to break up that which is existing. But the goddess says, the while I hold together all existence, beyond this wide earth and beyond the heavens, I have become so mighty in my grandeur. Beyond the heavens, because beyond all the profound states of consciousness, it is through speech that we are able to affirm the absolute ultimate, that there is the absolute, that there is this primordial creative energy, the unknown and the unknowable. We can say all extraordinary things like that. We can contradict our experience of our world in terms of finitude and temporality and mortality by postulating their opposites, by negating these and saying that there is the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. Speech can do this, you see. But if it is speech without an inner sensitivity behind it, animating it, giving it life, then of course they are mere words. And what a person says afterwards about all that sort of thing is generally so much waffle. Look at another thing about speech. In the Avastha, with regard to Zarathustra, this is said, he is eager to proclaim the glory of God and his eternal law in songs of praise to us. So let him be blessed with sweetness of speech. I think that's a wonderful statement. How many people in the world, how many of us, are always fulfill that sweetness of speech? So, unquestionably, we must be mindful of our speech. I mention speech because of its, and I'm talking so much about it, because it is so very, very important as far as the living of the moral life is concerned. The Hindus have an excellent teaching in connection with speech. If what is to be said is truthful, kind, and useful, and I would like to add, appropriate to the situation and circumstance and the person with whom we are speaking, then say it. If it is not, silence is best. Meister Eckhart said, the godly man talks readily only about God. What do I talk about quite readily? Food, sex, drink, excitement, pleasure, scandal, That is what I, the man of the world, talk about. Business. Becoming wealthy, possessing everything, dominating everything, climbing to the top of the tree. One has to really be sensitive to all these things. Otherwise, one never begins to know oneself. That's what Meister Eckhart said. Saint Teresa said, "How can your tongues be better employed when you are together than in praising God who has given us so much cause for it?" The Buddha strenuously upholds the Aryan silence, the noble silence. Aryan meaning noble, you see. He strenuously upholds the noble silence. "If speech there must be," he said, "let it deal with the discipline of the holy life or with the Dhamma, the teachings." Now, when the Buddha talked of the silence, the noble silence, specifically, it means the entry into the state of the second, what was called the second jhana. Why is this silence so very, very important? Why is it praised throughout all the scriptures of the world? And in the, I think it is in the Varaha Upanishad, the teaching is reiterated three times in succession. Practice silence. Practice silence. Practice silence. It is reiterated thrice like that. Now, the question arises, why is the silence so important? And this noble silence, this total silence, refers not only to holding one's tongue in everyday life, but in silent, in letting the stream of pointless chatter which goes on here become quietened down and become perfectly silent. All words represent things, persons, situations, relationships, everything that belongs to the conditioned sphere, to the mortal world. Our whole consciousness is constant, our brain is constantly chattering. It never stops chattering, except in those rare cases where you really enter the deep, dreamless sleep. But and it is in that state of sleep that the whole organism is rejuvenated, refreshed. You are charged with vitality. Life in its transcendent sense, prana in the true sense, you see, that begins to function then in that dreamless slumber and restores you to the healthy state. In that sleep, you are in complete harmony with the supreme harmony, the total harmony of the universe. Because in that deep dreamless slumber, no desire, no conflict, no pursuit of any ambition or anything enters to spoil that sleep. That is the state in which one has oneself gone back, as they say, as the Upanishads say, gone back to the Atma. But what is the drawback of that? When you wake up, all this world of turmoil starts up again. And as a matter of fact, even before one wakes, the turmoil starts and in the brain, and that wakes the body up again. That's how it happens, you see. All right, but if and when, through actually living the religious life and the practice of the discipline as such, the discipline in the true sense, not something which is just imposed upon you from outside to which you conform, you won't learn, you won't grow very much that way. You can, of course, converse with others, you can have relationships with others in which one is told, one is helped to understand. That is all right, because there is no conditioning influence by the greater power of the other person who is imposing it on you. Now, when through the living of the religious life one is able to realize that state of complete poise and peace and inward calm whilst one is awake, then the ceaseless chatter of the brain completely stops. It completely stops. What does that mean? We are conscious in the ordinary way in terms of self-association with every single thought, feeling, word and action, and everything that proceeds in time as such. When, therefore, the time process stops with the cessation of this constant chatter, mortality gives place to consciousness in terms of immortality. That is the first touch of your realization of the meaning of immortality. There is no other immortality. Here and now alone you realize immortality in that sense. And you become not only transformed psychophysically, but actually transfigured when this reaches its supreme point. You have the great religions bringing this out. Judaism, Moses was transfigured when he came, when he was in the Mount of the Lord. The Mount of the Lord is this, and in the deepest state of consciousness, the Sahasrara Chakra active. And his face shone. The transfiguration of Jesus is there. The transfiguration of Zarathustra has been taught. The transfiguration of the Buddha. These are all affirmations throughout the great religions. There is a real transfiguration which takes place. And in that transfigured state, physically itself, one is divinity embodied, divinity made manifest. Of course, it doesn't last forever, because it's the nature of the body, ultimately, quite naturally, to decay and to perish. The holiest of the holy ones all died, and they will all die. That is to say, physically. So now, one begins to see the importance of this silence, its significance, shall I say, rather than the importance. Don't try to grasp at the state of the silence as an ambition to be achieved. You will never succeed. You will only have misery as the consequence. So don't attempt to grasp at anything spiritual, any development in this personal, possessive, greedy manner. This is an expression of spiritual greed, just as the person who devours book after book is intellectually greedy. All that has to be, one has to get free of all that. So now, that much for speech. When that happens, you will find that our urges in life, our ambitions and our passion to achieve for oneself and all that will just disappear. And people will say, what will there be, what is there that will be left? There will be nothing left, but transcendence will fill your whole being and you will be a shining light in the world. You won't know it, but those who look at you will say, ah, look at that man. Something different, something quite extraordinary. That is what will happen. And it is the other person who will know it. When you are truly conscious in this manner, because your psyche is utterly pure, mind in its archetypal nature, its transcendent archetypal power functions freely through your psyche. That means also through your brain and through your body, that begins to function. And therefore that person, whatsoever he does, is really a savior. That is to say, a salver. Somebody who heals. He heals mankind. And then, what we call love and wisdom, the reality of these things naturally shines forth, because all these supreme spiritual values are constitutive of divinity itself, of the primordial creative energy and this absolute pure consciousness. These things are constitutive of that. We have to use our common words of the language, and these same words, remember, also belong to our dualistic context and operate in our ambivalent way. If we say love, we also know what hate is. If we say wisdom, we also know what folly is. But you see, when we really know, which is the unknowing knowing, then a transformative, a transmutative activity takes place. And the ambivalence of the psyche, the good and evil, the kind and the cruel, the generous and the mean, all undergo complete purification. If there is something good, there is also that thing better, isn't there? And there is something best. But all those comparative states disappear in the transcendent. Where the transcendent is concerned, there is no comparison whatsoever. So the purification is complete and absolute. And therefore, this origin from which we have come has manifested itself completely and fully through us as human beings, the happy creators. So you see the indispensability of the living of the moral life. This is something which is not sufficiently appreciated and certainly not sufficiently seriously taken in hand by most of us, if not all of us. Even though our interest in religion, in our interest in truth, starts as an intellectual curiosity which we want to satisfy. It is a form of greed, actually. Why do we change from one religion to another? Because we say, oh, it suits me better. I like it. I don't feel sympathy with this. But then I'm dividing up the world. I'm sinning. There is nothing to choose between the great religions. Because whatsoever was the perfect manifestation of the supreme truth is perfect. You can't compare perfection with perfection. It's absurdity. It's absurd. Can you compare the infinite with anything? Can you split up the infinite or the eternal or the immortal? You just can't do it. So you see, all these, when this happens in our own lives, we must always inquire why and how it happened. Here we are born in a particular situation, of particular parents, in a particular milieu. All right, let us understand that. That is our divinely given circumstance. And it is our business to let divinity realize itself fully through this particular circumstance and this particular being. So now I think I trust we have begun to understand the importance of this silence. Note carefully what we ourselves do. Never mind the other fellow. We always say, oh, that man, he just can't stop talking, or he can't, and that applies to a person like me very, very much, of course, you see. But never mind the other fellow. Be concerned with this one's own psychophysical organism and bring it to perfection, bring it to fruition. It is your happiness that will blossom out first and foremost thereby. If you are happy, you will naturally spread happiness. If you are like the sun, you will spread light and heat and warmth and comfort and beauty and loveliness and everything. You have to become like the sun. Your very presence will be a benediction in the world. And that perhaps is the... Well, it is. I was going to say that is the greatest reward for all your for your living the religious life. But then that puts it in a rather shopkeeperish form. It is the fruition of the transcendent purpose itself which matters. Nirvana manifests through you. You never attain nirvana. Not one of you, not anybody, will attain nirvana. But nirvana will naturally and spontaneously manifest itself through you if you are completely purified. What did the Buddha say? Cease to do evil, just as in the Upanishad, evil-mindedness is burnt out. Cease to do evil, strive to do good, purify, he said, the mind. I would say the psyche. In his day, no one used the word psyche. There is no word for psyche. But it is a very valuable word, differentiating this characterless, beginningless, endless, archetypal form of the creative energy, which is called mind, which releases cosmos, something which is a harmony. Something which is in total and complete and perfect relationship in all its parts. And today modern science has shown very clearly that the entire universe is completely interrelated and interactive within itself. And that's what constitutes the harmony of all existence. Your fulfillment, your end point, if one may talk in those terms, is just this, that there has taken place a complete transformation of your own mode of awareness of existence. And you have yourself grown into the perfected Holy One, the true human being. Thank you.